The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and pen impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading for you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Everyday Miracles. Brief Encounters of a Close Kind. I don't know how to say it except to say it, but it sounds like the paranoid nightmare of an overprotector parent. But this is what happened. I saw my 8-year-old son go over a waterfall. At this point, I need to tell you that he's fine, because when I tell this story, I can see people's faces contort as they conjure up horrible outcomes. It wasn't a huge fall, but in many other ways, it was huge. It was last August. We were on vacation, having driven from our home in Washington, D.C., to New Hampshire. We wouldn't see friends or family. It would be just me, my husband, and our 2 kids out for a nice, safe, socially distanced week away. We had hiked about half a mile to a popular spot called Diana's Baths, near the town of North Conway, where the waterfalls off a series of flat boulders laid up the mountainside like an M.C. Escher drawing. The baths were full of families, so we made our way to one of the upper levels of rock to keep our distance. Both where we sat and down below, the water cascaded and fell into a small pool, where kids in swimsuits were splashing around. I watched as some younger parents nervously corralled their toddlers away from the rock's edges, feeling grateful that my husband and I were out of that stage, that our kids, in 6 and 8, could navigate their physical space with more confidence. Don't get me wrong, I was still terrified as I saw my 2 boys jump between the slippery rocks. No running, I said again and again. Stay away from all those edges. But I soon relaxed. We were all having fun, splashing in the pools, my kids laughing as my husband dunked his head under the cold running water. Then second later, every fear I'd ever had rose to the surface. I turned and saw my son Wyatt sitting down between 2 boulders in a fast-moving stream. I yelled to him to get out. He yelled back something that I couldn't hear, and then he disappeared over the edge. All I remember from the moments after is screaming over and over, like a prayer, "Somebody help my son!" I didn't even know what help he needed, because I couldn't force myself to look. My husband was already sprinting down the rocks. I finally looked. Wyatt was sitting up. He was alive. My biggest fear was erased. As I held my younger son, Jed, close, I heard another woman scream. "That child just went over the waterfall," she shouted to her husband. "We are leaving." They walked away and never even looked back to see whether our child was okay. It was about 12 feet from the top of the waterfall into the pool below, which was studded with huge rocks. Wyatt had fallen on his back straight under the rocks. That's what Lisa told us. We don't know her name. We didn't know her name was Lisa at that point. All we knew was that while everyone else looked on from a distance, too afraid or unbothered to help, this petite brunette with a mask didn't hesitate. In fact, by the time I had climbed down the rocks and my husband had pulled Wyatt out of the water, she had already called 911. She told me that she was a nurse. She gave Wyatt a red, white, and blue striped towel to put under his head. She implored us to keep him still and on his back in case he had injured his spinal cord. I finally had wherewithal to ask her name. "Lisa," she said, "and I'm not leaving you." I knew she was a mother. I saw her kid standing a few feet back. I couldn't see her face, just her eyes. But she looked at me so deeply it was as if she were trying to take every bit of energy, love, and strength in her body and push it out through the only part of her face I could see. I held onto that energy like a rope that could pull us to safety, to some other place in time where my son wasn't writhing in pain. The rescue team came. They took Wyatt out of the park on a stretcher. An ambulance took us to the small local hospital. From there, Wyatt was transferred to a larger trauma hospital in Portland, Maine, where they could better assess him. There were tests and scans. Asleep that night in the hospital, but by morning we got the all clear. Wyatt had broken 3 ribs and a punctured lung, injuries that sound horrific but heal on their own. As soon as I knew that Wyatt was going to be okay, my thoughts fell to Lisa. If she had not stepped up, would someone else have done so? Perhaps, but it was her. She was the one who went toward the unthinkable instead of turning away. And something else had happened that I hadn't realized right away. I felt so drawn to her, so strengthened by her, because she stepped into what had been a void in my life during the pandemic. I miss strangers. Meeting Lisa reminded me how I longed for connections with people I do not know. A random shared joke with someone in an elevator. A quip that turns into a conversation with a store clerk. The banter with a chatty restaurant server. Even the most casual interactions with strangers make me feel less strange. I need to feel as if we aren't all floating around on our own bubbles. If we stop connecting with those we don't know, if we stop being able to see ourselves in them, Where are we as people, as a society? What are we left with? On that mountainside in New Hampshire, their circumstances were anything but casual, and as a result of the moment, even more intimacy and power. All of that has sustained me since. Lisa and I have exchanged several text messages. She sent gifts for our kids, individual wrapped Lego sets with a handmade card. We told each other how nervous we were about our kids going to school in person. It's not the drama of two mothers on the side of a waterfall, one holding the other through her worst fear. But every interaction that now follows, no matter how mundane, will be built on that. And in this world that has also violently shaken all of us, that has dizzied us and bruised us in our own isolation, we are two strangers who are less strange. The Healthy. Wellness from thehealthy.com. The benefits of cuddling. The COVID-19 crisis has reminded us all that humans don't just crave a hug or a friendly touch. We absolutely need it. As a nurse working on the front line in Denver, 32-year-old Janae Hinkson knows a few things about the stress brought on about the pandemic. In addition to all the well-documented strains on healthcare workers, she adds another one, minimal human interaction at work where she's wearing PPE all day, and fewer hugs and cuddles at home. I always shower and change clothes before I touch the kids. They know the drill now. My daughter will jump up and down and say, "Mom, you have hospital germs. Take a shower so we can snuggle," she says. Which Hickson does, stat. Nothing beats hugs and snuggles with my husbands and kiddos after a rough shit at the hospital. Cuddling with them on the couch makes me feel instantly happy and calmer. As a result of COVID-19 precautions, many of us are part of this secondary epidemic. People who really need a hug. More than half of the 40,000 people who participated in the BBC's Touch Test, a survey conducted in 112 countries in collaboration with Wellcome Collection, said they didn't get enough physical interaction, an arm around the shoulder, a sympathetic touch, or a long snuggle. And that was before the pandemic set in. In April 2020, as the COVID-related lockdowns were taking effect, that number increased to 60%, according to a study published by the Medical Research Archives of the European Society of Medicine. It was true, regardless of whether a person lived alone or with others. Healthcare professionals have given a name to this condition that is affecting so much of society. Touch starvation. Cuddling and hugging aren't for everyone, of course. Some people feel uncomfortable when others touch them. Roughly 90% of participants in the touch test reporting liking physical affection from their partners, and 79% said they liked it when a friend touched them. That instinct to seek out human touch is more powerful than most of us realize. We were born as cuddlers, and we never really outgrow it, says James Cordova, Ph.D., a psychology professor and clinical psychologist who directs the Center for Couples and Family Research at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. I honestly think cuddling should be among the most basic prescriptions for human flourishing. Touch starvation may sound touchy-feely in the most literal sense, but the idea is supported by hardcore biology. It starts with hormones. Cuddling increases the level of oxytocin, the bonding hormone, and decreases levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, said Linda Velikova, MD, an immunologist, researcher, and assistant professor at Sofia University in Bulgaria. Those same hormones can affect your cardiovascular system in your sleep and even your mental health. Cuddling activates our parasympathetic nervous system, bringing feelings of calm and ease while settling feelings of anxiety and sadness, Cordova says. Blood pressure is often linked to stress, so anything that reduces stress can help bring it down. In addition, oxytocin has a protective effect on the heart. Physical touch is also an essential part of how human beings communicate, according to Sabina Romanoff, PsyD, a clinical psychologist at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City. Part of the power of physical touch comes from the very fact that it does not involve spoken language, she says. Body language is often harder to fake. The act of cuddling implicitly communicates trust and safety in ways you can't speak. And most of us are unaware of the power of touch. People who got regular hugs were less likely to get sick when exposed to a cold virus than people who didn't get physical affection, according to research published in Psychological Science. Snuggles can even reduce physical pain. Reaching for a loved one's hand for comfort is a natural reaction. A study published in 2018 in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that this very act can help diminish pain, especially if the person you are touching is someone you feel close to personally. Even minor physical contact can be beneficial to both of you, Romanoff says. Cuddlers and snugglers also sleep better. More than 60% of those who responded to the touch test survey said a hug from a partner before sleep had a positive effect on their night. The oxytocin triggered by touch helps reduce the fight or flight impulses that stress produces, helping you fall asleep faster, Natalie Velikova says. It also aids digestion, making for a more restful sleep. How to cuddle. Not all cuddling is created equal, and there's no right way to do it. It could be lying next to each other in bed, spooning, or other types of loving touches, Romanoff says. If one way doesn't feel right, try something else. Foot rubs, head rubs, back rubs, hand-holding, laying your head on someone's chest, sitting on a lap, or side by side on the couch with legs touching. All of these things count. There are even different types of hug. For people who aren't fully comfortable with physical touch and are not accustomed to giving or receiving physical affection, it's important to start slow, both in the quantity and quality of physical contact. Take the time to find out what you like, what your hug partner likes, and what your friends and loved ones enjoy. Learn to speak their physical love language, Romanoff says. Don't focus solely on snuggling with your partner. Children are natural cuddlers, and appropriate cuddling between parents and kids is essential to development, teaches kids about good physical boundaries, and helps form tight, loving bonds. Parents need to hold their kids in their arms, Dr. Velikova says. Even a gentle pat on the hand or forehead can do wonders. While doing it, says something loving to increase your kid's sense of security and warmth. You can also look beyond humans to meet your cuddly needs. Pets are awesome snuggle buddies. There's a reason why therapy animals exist. Petting and loving animals can help you feel better. This can be especially important for people who don't have a human companion to cuddle with. Hickson gave birth at the beginning of the pandemic, which adds another layer of stress, responsibility, and worry. However, the new little one has been a blessing to the whole family, and because of her need to be held often and cuddled often, baby snuggles are the best medicines, he said. I tried it, telemedicine. Once my appointment was scheduled, I received specific instructions to download an app for my smartphone. Whatever device you are using, make sure it is fully charged. As with in-person doctor visits, you still might wait to see your doctor, but at least you're waiting in your own home. Pick a quiet space for the visit. Avoid high-traffic areas such as the kitchen or living room. Often just navigating the technology can create stress. I wrote down my questions ahead of time, which is a good idea for in-person visits as well. Can CBD help you sleep? Cannabidol, CBD, has been touted as a treatment for pain, depression, and epilepsy, and even anxious pets. More than 40% of CBD users say they tried it to help them sleep, yet evidence of its effectiveness as a sleep aid is limited. A review paper in Current Psychiatry reports the studies showing that CBD can be effective for sleep apnea, REM sleep behavior disorder, PTSD nightmares, and sleep issues in people with chronic pain. But people who believe that CBD helped them with more generalized sleep problems might be reacting instead to its anti-anxiety properties, says Martin E. Lee, co-founder and director of Project CBD, a California nonprofit that promotes CBD research. Another study published in Current Neuropharmacology found that a low dose, 15 milligrams of CBD, may actually keep some people awake. And Lee emphasizes that CBD does not work like a sleeping pill. If you take CBD before you go to sleep, you're liable to be up all night, he says. Even continuing research proves CBD effective for sleep in some people. Check with your doctor, especially if you take medications such as blood thinners. CBD tends to be well tolerated, but it can have some side effects. And more news from the world of medicine. Deep sleep may defend against Alzheimer's. Each day as your brain cells consume energy, they create waste products. These include beta amyloid, a compound that's found in the abnormal levels in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease. Scientists believe that a healthy brain cleans out this unneeded substance during sleep. A dreamless part of the sleep cycle known as slow-wave sleep. In a 6-year California study, seniors who experience less slow-wave sleep tend to accumulate more beta amyloid. This suggests you can reduce your Alzheimer's risk by practicing good sleep habits and seeking treatment for sleep disorders such as chronic insomnia and sleep apnea. When pain or weakness lingers after COVID-19. After surviving COVID-19, some people are left with pain, numbness, or weakness in their hands, feet, arms, or legs. While some of the causes of nerve damage symptoms are known, including inflammation from the body's immune response and hematomas caused by blood thinners used for COVID-19 treatment, doctors have been at a loss as to what to do about them. A new radiology review proposes a good first step, a high-resolution ultrasound or magnetic resonance neurography. A damaged nerve in one place can trigger symptoms elsewhere, but these imaging methods can pinpoint the exact location and nature of the injury. Depending on what is revealed, treatment might include pain medication, physical therapy, immunotherapy, or surgery. Stress-related dental problems on the rise. If you wake up with a headache or a sore jaw, you might be grinding your teeth in the night, and you've not been alone. Stress often triggers this problem, and a survey conducted last spring in Israel and Poland found that the COVID-19 pandemic is making the condition more widespread. During Israel's first lockdown, the rate of people who suspected they were grinding jumped from 10 to 36%. To prevent tooth damage, dentists can make a mouth guard to wear at night. To reduce the stress at the root of this habit, many activities can help. Working out, meditating, deep breathing, watching a funny show, or simply indulging in a leisure activity that you enjoy. And I will testify to the effectiveness of that mouth guard. Years ago, I had a lot of stress, and I was grinding my teeth, and my dentist made me one of those mouth things that I wore in bed at night. And boy, did it make a difference. A couple months later, the problem was gone, and I wasn't grinding my teeth anymore. Keeping bones strong without meat. In theory, you can get the nutrients you need without eating meat or dairy. Yet a British study found a significantly increased risk of hip fractures in vegetarians, pescatarians, and especially vegans. Protein and calcium, which are both essential to bone health, are found in soup plant-based foods such as beans, lentils, broccoli, and cabbage, so to be sure, include them in your meals. Older people at risk of STIs. It's not only high schoolers who need sex education. In a survey of Europeans over age 45, two-thirds of the respondents said they had never used protection against sexually transmitted infections, STIs, and more than half had never been tested for those they could be carrying. Shame and stigma were cited as among the biggest barriers stopping people from accessing sexual health care services. Over the long term, certain untreated STIs can lead to chronic pelvic pain, cardiovascular damage, and an increased risk of cancer. So unless you're in a long-term monogamous relationship, it's a good idea to openly discuss the topic with your doctor. Can online doctor ratings be trusted? Online ratings make it easier to choose which phone, car, or dishwasher to buy, but are they equally useful when it comes to picking a doctor or learning about the one you have? Not always, according to a University of Texas at Dallas study focused on chronic disease care. When a patient has a curable problem, strep throat treated with antibiotics, for example, they will clearly know whether their medical care was successful and may be more likely to give a satisfactory assessment online. But when it comes to ongoing diseases such as diabetes, asthma, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, which aren't cured but rather are managed, the signs that a doctor is doing a good job are less obvious. As you'd expect, then, when researchers investigated how patients with COPD fared with various doctors over a period of 10 years, star ratings on websites didn't line up very well with more objective ways of measuring the quality of their care, such as the rate of patients who developed complications or needed to visit an emergency room. Some of the information written online reviews might be reliable. Observations about a doctor's friendliness or the cleanliness of their office. These things matter too. But when it comes to medical outcomes for chronic diseases, you can't depend too much on what you see on the web. Better management for type 1 diabetes. Instead of repeatedly pricking their fingers, people with type 1 diabetes can rely on continuous glucose monitors, CGMs. With the help of a tiny sensor inserted under the skin, a CGM measures your blood sugar level continuously and can alert you via a handheld monitor whatever it is and within the right range. Do they help? Yes. In a Swedish study, switching to a CGM helped patients decrease their average blood sugar level. They also suffered few other episodes of too low blood sugar. Most subjects also found using the device more comfortable than the alternative. The FDA has approved several CGMs, including one that is safe to use in patients as young as 2 years old. Most private insurance covers the cost, those approved by the FDA, and as of April 2021, Medicare does as well. How about some quotable quotes? There's a picture here of Chris Stapleton. And Chris Stapleton has hair that hangs down to his chest and a big full beard. And his quote is, "If not shaving or combing your hair is superstitious, then I guess I've been superstitious for years." What if they are true, the true dwelling of the holy, these fleeting temples we make together when we say, "Here, have my seat. Go ahead. You first." Donatian Lamiris, poet. "I feels like a 10,000-pound weight went from the left shoulder to the right shoulder now that I've got the job, because I've got to do it well." Kim Ng, baseball's first female general manager. "You can take a girl out of the Midwest, but don't come for her baby back ribs." Shonda Rhimes, TV producer. "Don't spend any time whatsoever thinking about what might have been." Alex Trebek, game show host. After a long sequestered year, many of us feel the itch to travel again. Before you start to pack the car, let these five signature drives inspire your plans and your wanderlust. And there's a picture here of a highway stretching in the distance with mountains, rocky cliffs, and everything else in the distance. Number one, America's Highway, Route 66. I have a former fellow worker who rode all the way from eastern North Carolina to California on his motorcycle, and this is when he was 67 years old on Route 66. It starts in Chicago, ends in Santa Monica, California, 2,448 miles. The mother road, America's Highway, the main street of America, the real Rogers Highway, Route 66 goes by many names. But there's one thing everyone can agree on. Historic Route 66 is the quintessential American experience, says Ken Busby, executive director and CEO of the Route 66 Alliance. It speaks to westward migration during the Great Depression, a road of hopes and dreams and opportunities. Route 66 also represents the entrepreneurial spirit of America. From Kitsch to Clathics, these only here spots are worth the trip themselves. A few favorite roadside pit stops. Follow the 1960s green and yellow neon sign to Whalen's Cuckoo Burger drive-thru for towers of sweet, soft-served, crisp-fried pickle spares and sizzling burgers in Miami, Oklahoma. Hunker down for a nostalgic Shay at the Blue Swallow Motel, circa 1940, in Tucumcari, New Mexico. And don't miss the photo ops at the world's largest ketchup bottle in Collinsville, Illinois, or the graffiti monoliths at Cadillac Ranch in Amarillo, Texas. As with most road trips, Route 66 is more about the journey than the destination, as you roll along from Chicago to Santa Monica, California. It's not the road, and it's not the attractions. It's the people, says CEO of Mother Road Enterprises, Jim Conkle, who has traveled Route 66 more than 200 times since his first trip in 1949. The people are from all walks of life, from every country in the world. It's really a smorgasbord of cultures and languages. If you travel Route 66 and don't immerse yourself with the people, you're missing the key to the whole experience, he says. You're more likely to come away from any trip on Route 66 with a whole bunch of new friends, a fitting souvenir from America's Highway. Number two, the Ultima Florida Beach Trip. Starts in Tarpon Springs, Florida, and ends in Sanibel Island, Florida, only 170 miles. With 1,350 miles of unbroken coastline, Florida is America's undisputed sand and surf playground. And its undisputed seaside capital is Miami? Daytona? Key West? In fact, last year TripAdvisor reported the top beach in Florida, in fact of all of America, is Siesta Key, just south of Sarasota. If you've never heard of it, perhaps that's because the Floridians try to keep this most coveted secret to themselves. Siesta Key is one of the many underappreciated and not-too-crowded beaches you'll find on this drive along Florida's aptly named Sun Coast. Start on Route 19 northwest of Tampa and head south through the slice after slice of sandy Gulf paradise, including Tarpon Springs, the sponge capital of the world, the Scottish-like fishing village of Dunedin, and Clearwater's Colodesy Island, which Dr. Beach, a.k.a. Stephen Leatherman, Ph.D., the director of the Laboratory for Coastal Research at Florida International University, has put at the top of his own best beaches in America list. The turquoise-tinged beauty is everywhere. Fort DeSoto Park delivers sunset that rival Key West any day, and it's home to a menagerie of pelicans, herons, egrets, sea turtles, and Florida's iconic dolphins. Travels a few hours south on I-75 and over the Sanibel Causeway to Sanibel and Captiva Islands, two old Florida retreats. no buildings taller than a palm tree. Together, the two islands claim the title of the seashell capital of the world, a distinction they owe to a quirk of geography. They are among the few barrier islands that run perpendicular to the mainland, which allows them to snag the currants, conch, whelk, and other shells in their crescent-shaped clutches. Stop over and you might find yourself captive to the island's charm, too. And there's a picture of a bicycle completely coated with sponges and seashells. Number 3, Iowa's Great River Road. Starts in Keokuka, Iowa, ends in Lansing, Iowa, 241 miles. And there's a picture of a steamboat sitting right next to a big, well, actually there's two steamboats, a smaller steamboat and a big steamboat. A riverboat. Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Showboat, The Blues. The Mississippi River is arguably our most inspiring natural landmark. If you have a lot of time on your hands, you can ride shotgun with Old Man River, all of 2,350 miles from the Gulf of Mexico to northwest Minnesota. Or you can sample what makes this river unique by giving Iowa stretch of the Great River Road a try. The Hawkeye State's 328 miles of the river road wind by more cultural and education centers than it does in any other state. A good place to start is Keokuk, home to the George M. Verity Riverboat Museum. Its collection of maritime artifacts and information is housed appropriately aboard an historic paddlewheel boat. The water is the star of the trip, but the scenery throughout Iowa puts its own show, from the low riverbeds to the dramatic limestone bluffs sculpted over millennia by glacial meltwater. A 3-hour drive north of Keokuk brings you to Leclerc, birthplace of Buffalo Bill Cody, and home to the museum that honors his contributions as an explorer of the West and the Native Americans he encountered. From there on, it's on to Dubuque, Iowa's oldest city and a favorite haunt of Al Capone. You'll find the Natural Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium here, along with its resident alligators, river otters, and turtles. You can tour a bit of 19th century America and historic McGregor, where Pikes Peak State Park provides one of the most expansive views anywhere along the Mississippi. About 15 miles to the north, Harper's Ferry is home to Iowa's most significant Native American relics, the 1,600-year-old representations of birds, bears, and more at Effigy Mounds National Monument. The sacred spot preserves 200 mounds from more than 20 tribes on 2,500 acres. Right along to the high scenic bluffs of Yellow River State Forest, home to 65 species of birds, on your way to Lansing's 450-foot-high Mount Hosmer Park. On a clear day, you can see for 50 miles, Wisconsin to the east and Minnesota to the north. Number 4, 5-in-1 Drive, National Parks. Starts in Zion National Park, Utah, and ends in Canyonlands National Park, Utah, 352 miles. Picture here of the Stone Arch. Sculpted by wind and water over countless millennia, the remote canyons and plateaus of southeastern Utah were among the last part of the American West to be seen by travelers from the east. What a difference a century or two can make. Today, that rugged landscape is home to some of the most popular national parks in the country. Collectively known as the Mighty Five, they boast dramatic desert landscapes, soaring arches, deep slot canyons, and reach-for-the-sky rocky spires. You'll need several days to take in all the national wonders, starting with the red rock landscape of chasms and hanging gardens at Zion National Park. The views here may make you feel as if you're flying, especially at Angel's Landing, which is just 1,488 feet above the Virgin River. Head 70 miles northwest along 89A to Bryce Canyon National Park. It's by the soaring orange rock formations known as hoodoos, long before you arrive at the park gates. Next up, how about a trip to Mars? The red sandstone of Capitol Reef National Park, 100 miles to the northeast, so resembles the look of the red planet that a Mars Desert Research Station is located here. Roll 130 miles north for another underworldly site, Arches National Park. More than 2,000 dazzling stone arches, the largest profusion of national arches in the world. Bonus, if you discover a new one of these color restorations, you get to name it. Finally, drive on to the Needle Pinnacles rock mazes and remote canyons carved by the Colorado and Green Rivers at neighboring Canyonlands National Park. The vast wilderness area offers crowd-free experiences in its remote reaches that will make you feel as if you're all alone with these mesmerizing landscapes. Number 5, History and Foliage in New England. Starts in Athol, Massachusetts, and ends in Williamstown, Massachusetts. It's only 63 miles. and there's a fall picture of the Connecticut River with the mountains all around it in full bloom for the fall. Other than a great cup of chowder, New England vacationers essentially want two things, a little bit of history and a lot of foliage. You'll find them both on Massachusetts Mohawk Trail, one of the nation's first designated scenic highways. The Mohawk people once used this byway across the Berkshire Hills as a trading route, and armies from colonial Boston traveled it to defend the western frontier. Among the gems you'll find today, a Quaker meeting house in Adams built in 1782, the nearby birthplace of Susan B. Anthony. They are both at the western edge of this one-day drive, which follows Route 2 east to the northwest part of the state. Natural and constructed beauty intertwine everywhere, as in the hills of the Natural Bridge State Park, home to the only white marble bridge in North America. There's a bridge of another kind in Shelburne Falls, the Blooming Bridge of Flowers, a former trolley path teeming with hundreds of varieties of flowers, vines, and shrubs. Driven on, you'll encounter a hairpin turn that will make you feel as if you're on a roller coaster, twisting almost 180 degrees straight down a hillside. Not enough of an adrenaline rush? Try flying through the treetops on a zip line tour in Charlemont. If you prefer to be amazed with 2 feet firmly on the ground, stop in North Adams to marvel at the visual and performing arts offered at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. Housed in the former Sprague Electric Company plant, Mass MoCA is one of the largest contemporary art centers in the country, with 28 buildings spread across 16 acres. It's home to indoor and outdoor dance and music theater spaces, as well as some of the finest large-scale sculpture exhibitions in the world. After all that man-made art, you'll be ready for more of Mother Nature's. It's only a 5-mile drive to the top of Mount Greylock, the highest peak in Massachusetts. From the observation tower at summit, you'll get a bird's-eye view of the entire sweep of the Berks. You might even spot a bald eagle from your perch. And I'm surprised they skipped the road in western North Carolina and Tennessee. That would have been a nice description here. And with that, let's switch over to the special report for Consumer Reports. And this is not exactly a wonderful report. How safe is our drinking water? CR investigated the nation's tap water. Here's what the results mean for you, plus how to test and treat your own water. In Connecticut, a condo had lead in its drinking water at levels more than double what the federal government deems acceptable. At a church in North Carolina, the water was contaminated with extremely high levels of potentially toxic PFA chemicals. The water flowing into a Texan home had both, and concerning amounts of arsenic, too. All three were among locations that had water tested as part of a 9-month investigation by the Consumer Reports and the Guardian U.S. News Organization into the nation's drinking water. Since the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972, access to safe water for all Americans has been a stated U.S. government goal. Yet millions of people continue to face serious water quality problems because of contamination, deteriorating infrastructure, and inadequate treatment at water plants. CR and the Guardian selected 120 people from around the U.S. out of a pool of more than 6,000 volunteers to test for arsenic, lead, PFAS, per and polyfluoroalkyl substances and other contaminants. The samples came from water systems that together service more than 19 million people. The study has some limitations. The quality of the water at one location on a single day doesn't necessarily affect the quality of the water supplies by an entire system or at other times. But the ambitious undertaking with the community water systems chosen by CR statisticians from a representative mix of systems across the country provides a unique view into some of the most significant challenges in America's ongoing drinking water crises. The challenges don't stem from technology problem. Filtration systems can cleanse water of contaminants, yet they are not being used uniformly by community water systems. Indeed, almost every sample tested had measurable levels of PFAS, a group of compounds found in hundreds of household products. These chemicals are linked to learning delays in children, cancer, and other health problems. More than 35% exceeded safety thresholds that CR scientists and other health experts believe should be the maximum. Yet many consumers have never heard of PFAS. Young Ning, a resident of Florida, New York, says he has a long time used home water filters in part to remove lead. But the 69-year-old says he didn't know anything about PFAS until he had his water tested as part of this investigation, which found comparatively high levels of the chemicals in his water. "Now I've got to find something to fill out the PFAS," Eng says. CR's test revealed another problem as well. About 8% of samples had levels of arsenic, which gets into drinking water through natural deposits or industrial or agricultural pollution, above CR's recommended maximum for drinking water. Almost every sample had measurable amounts of lead, a heavy metal that leaches from corroding water lines and home plumbing fixtures. It is unsafe at any level. In response to CR's findings, Environmental Protection Agency spokesman Andrea Drinkard, her name is Drinkard, and she doing the water stuff, that's pretty interesting, says that 93% of the population supplied by community water systems gets water that meets all health-based standards all of the time, and that the agency has set standards for more than 90 contaminants. That includes arsenic and lead, but does not include the PFAS. America's water crisis, while widespread, affects some communities more than others. According to an analysis of more than 140,000 public water systems published by The Guardian in February, it found that access to clean drinking water is highly unequal in the U.S., with water systems that service poor and rural counties far more likely to have violations than those that provide water to healthier urban ones. Water systems in counties with large Latino populations were particularly likely to have violations, The Guardian found. PFAS, the forever chemical problem. The PFAS results from CR's test are particularly troubling. Manufacturers use PFAS to make stain-resistant fabrics, carpets, and water-repellent clothing, non-stick cookware, and hundreds of other common products. The compound can seep into water from factories, landfills, and other sources, and because they don't easily break down in the environment, they're often called forever chemicals. Investigation into the health effects of PFAS exposure is ongoing. But some of the strongest evidence about their potential risks comes from research of about 69,000 people in and around Parkersburg, West Virginia. The research, part of a settlement between DuPont, which makes some PFAS and residents of the community, which was depicted in the 2019 movie Dark Waters, which was a very, very good and scary movie. It found a probable link between exposure to a PFAS and six health problems: high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, thyroid disease, pregnancy-induced hypertension, and testicular and kidney cancers. Research also links some PFASs to learning delays in children. Most Americans have trace amounts of PFAS in their blood, according to the research by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and at least 2,337 communities in 49 states have drinking water known to be contaminated with PFAS, according to a January analysis by the Environmental Working Group, an advocacy organization. CR's test results confirmed the ubiquity of the chemicals. We found PFAS in 117 of the 120 samples we tested from locations across the country. Despite mounting evidence of widespread contamination and health risk, the EPA still has not set an enforceable legal limit for PFAS in drinking water. Instead, it has established only voluntary limits, which apply to just two of the better studied forever chemicals, PFOA, or perfluorooctanoic acid, and PFOS, or perfluorooctanosulfonic acid, at 70 parts per trillion combined. For context, 1 part per trillion is the equivalent of 1 grain of sand in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, according to some estimates. Many public health experts think those levels are far too high. Harvard Environmental Health Professor Philippe Grandjean, Ph.D., has suggested that the limit should be just 1 ppt for PFOA and PFOSs, citing his 2013 research partly funded by the EPA, showing decreased vaccine response in children exposed to the chemicals. The EWG supports that threshold for total PFAS, pointing to Grandjean's work as well as other research linking PFAS to health problems in rodents. CR's chief scientific officer, James Dickerson, Ph.D., agrees that when it comes to PFAS, the lower the better. CR scientists say the maximum allowed amount should be 5 points per trillion for a single PFAS chemical and 10 points per trillion for two or more. That is in line with the standards for bottled water that an industry group, the International Bottled Water Association, has its members adhere to. Among the 120 samples CR tested, more than a third had PFAS levels above 10 points per trillion, and more than a quarter exceeded 5 points per trillion for a single PFAS chemical. Two samples had PFAS's levels above the federal advisor level of 70 points per trillion, with the highest amount, 80.2 points per trillion, come from a sample that Jim Vaughn, a 76-year-old retired electrical equipment salesman, collected at his church in Pittsboro, North Carolina. Vaughn wasn't particularly surprised, he says. Places such as Pittsboro, a community of about 6,700 on the fringes of North Carolina's Research Triangle, which is where we're broadcasting from, and filled with industry and high-tech businesses, are used to getting dumped on, he says. It's that little feeling of helplessness. Is there somewhere something in the town will do about it, or will we let it ride? Indeed, residents of Pittsboro have reason to worry. Beyond the results of CR's test, in 2007, an EPA study found PFAS contamination in the Cape Fear River Basin, a major source of drinking water for the eastern half of North Carolina. Some of the highest levels came from the Haw River and the basin's north end, where Pittsboro gets its water. Ongoing research out of Duke University and nearby Durham has also raised concerns. It found that the level of PFAS in a study of 49 Pittsboro residents' blood are 2 to 4 times higher than that of the general U.S. population. Heather Stapleton, Ph.D., the project's lead investigator, says Vaughn's test results align with her team's findings. Stapleton's team found a striking similarity between the levels of PFAS in the blood of Pittsboro residents and residents of the city of Wilmington and Fayetteville, downstream from Pittsboro, raising concerns that the drinking water in those communities could be contaminated with PFAS too. If you think about the number of communities that could be impacted, it's close to 1 million people, or 10% of North Carolina's population, she says. Chris Kennedy, town manager for Pittsboro, says the town was not a source of PFAS, but it was diligently working towards removing PFAS from our potable water supply. He adds that the town is installing filters at the water treatment plant to remove at least 90% of PFAS by the end of 2021 and is taking steps to reduce contamination into the Haw River, which will provide the best results long term. Arsenic, a toxin in the water. More than 1,200 miles away from Pittsboro, Sandy and Scott Phillips sat around their kitchen table in Texas on a weekday in February, reflecting on the test results for their water sample. Last year, looking to downsize, they built the custom home of their dreams in a new development in Round Rock, 20 miles north of Austin. Sandy Phillips especially enjoyed picking out everything from the floors to the kitchen cabinets. "We paid a little extra for the white cabinets because I just love the clean look," she says. What the couple didn't get to pick was their tap water supplier. Soon after moving in, they began to notice the water had an unusual odor, prompting them to invest thousands in a water softening and reverse osmosis water filtration system. Not long after, the couple got their water tested as part of CR's project, taking samples from water before it was filtered. The results were concerning, not just in the high of PFAS, 32.8 points per trillion, but also in arsenic at 3.3 parts per billion. "We get this gorgeous house," Sandy Phillips says, "and then the water is terrible." Bill Brown, general manager of the Jonah Water Special Utility District, the couple's water supplier, said it has complied with all federal and state minimum contaminant level standards for arsenic and lead for many years. He says that while CR's result conflicted with its records, the water district will investigate. He did not comment on the PFAS as found in Phillips's water. Excuse me, got to turn a page here. My apologies. In the early 2000s, EPA considered the drinking water limit for arsenic a 3 points per billion before settling on 10 points per billion as the amount that balances the cost for water system operators while reducing health risk. CR scientists have long said the EPA should set a limit of 3 pounds per billion or lower, in line with other health experts and environmental advocacy groups such as the National Resources Defense Council, NRDC, have called for. Almost every sample CR tested had measurable levels of arsenic, including 10, or about 8%, with levels between 3 and 10 points per billion. Previous tests from CR and others have shown elevated levels in juices and baby foods. Hundreds of water systems have exceeded the EPA's 10 point per billion limit, and the research indicates that the percentage of systems violating the rule has dropped over time. A 2017 NRDC study found that more than 500 systems provided water with excessive arsenic to 1.8 million people in the U.S. in 2015. Research suggests that exposure to even low levels of arsenic can pose health risk over the long term. A 2014 study in the Journal of Environmental Health found an association between water with arsenic of 5 points per billion greater and a 5 to 6 point IQ reduction in children. Two states, New Hampshire and New Jersey, have lowered their arsenic limit to 5 points per billion, citing warnings from studies. The EPA itself even sets a maximum contaminant level goal, the level below which there is no known or expected risk to health. It's at zero for arsenic. Lead. There is no safe amount. The Phillipses in Texas were especially fortunate to have installed a filtration system because the results of their unfiltered tap test showed high levels of not only arsenic, but also lead at 5.8 points per billion. CR's test, follow-up test, of the couple's filtered water showed trace amounts of lead and levels of arsenic and PFASs well within CR's recommended levels. The risk of lead and problems with how water utilities test for it became a national concern when news of the water crisis in Flint, Michigan exploded in 2015. Scientists in the EPA agreed that there's no safe exposure level of lead. But taking into consideration the feasibility of achieving lower levels, the EPA says utilities have to take significant steps to lower lead levels, including placing lead service lines, only when 10% of samples from homes in their service areas exceed 15 points per billion. Consumer advocate says though EPA regulations are problematic, a reality underscored by the testing results of water being piped into a condo by Stephen and Robin Newberg in New Britain, Connecticut. Lead typically works its way into drinking water through lead pipes that feed people's homes or in the home's plumbing itself. That underscores the need for more robust residential water testing, including samples from far more homes than currently required, experts say. While New Britain's annual water quality report for customers indicates its average lead level is 6 points per billion, the Newberg's results showed a concentration of 31.2 points per billion, more than double the EPA's action level of 5 points per billion. Stephen Newberg, a former postal worker, says he drinks filtered water and his wife drinks bottled water, so he's not personally worried, but the 66-year-old sits on the board of his condo and is concerned about the possibility of heavy metal being in his neighbor's water. He plans to raise the issue at an upcoming meeting. The results caught him and his wife off guard. The lead really did surprise us, he says. Ramon Esponda, New Britain's Deputy Director of Public Works, says the city complies with the EPA's lead regulations based on its 2020 tests, which found the average level of 2 points per billion. Esponda says the results of a single sample may be thrown off by new fixtures, recent plumbing work, or other factors. The installation of new lead service lines, pipes that connect a water main to a street to individual buildings, was banned in 1986, but an estimated 3 million to 6 million homes and businesses nationwide still get water through older lines that contain lead, according to EPA estimates. An untold number of homes have plumbing fixtures made of heavy metal. Exposure can especially risk in children, such as reduced IQ and behavioral problems. The Newberg's results were only ones in the CR test to be above the EPA action level, but almost every sample had measurable levels of health, and health experts emphasize that no amount of lead is safe. Eric Olson, Senior Strategic Director of Health and Food at the National NRDC, says the Newberg's result illustrates several problems with how the EPA regulates lead. One is that water systems typically test for lead only once every 3 years, and larger systems can get waivers to test every 9 years. Another is that the sample sizes are generally small. Even in a large city, they may only test 50 homes, Olson says. Systems are supposed to test homes that have lead service lines and plumbing and fixtures, but that requirement is often skirted too, he says. There's very little oversight, and they may not be testing at the highest risk homes. C.R. Dickerson agrees that the EPA needs to require municipalities to take many more samples from taps inside homes to better protect consumers. The EPA, in the waning days of the Trump administration, finalized changes to the lead regulation that will require testing in elementary schools and establish new rules according to steps water systems take when lead is detected. But the NRDC, the NAACP, and the other groups recently sued the EPA, saying those steps didn't go far enough, and urged the Biden administration to improve on them. In particular, the NRDC says, the revised rule would leave lead service lines in place for decades. EPA spokesperson Drinkard, citing the pending litigation, says the agency has no additional information to share. The fix. People seeking cleaner drinking water do have some options for reducing their exposure to dangerous contaminants, but consumer advocates say that fixing the problem shouldn't be up to consumers. Americans shouldn't have to navigate bureaucracy and be forced to make significant investments in order to access clean tap water, says Brian Roldholm, CR's Director of Food Policy. The implementation of strong standards would ensure everyone has access to clean water, regardless of their income levels. Legislation passed last year by the House of Representatives would have authorized a $22.5 billion to replace lead service lines across the U.S., according to the NRDC. But the bill died in the Senate. The NRDC called for the Biden administration and Congress to enact legislation requiring the expeditious removal and replacement of lead lines. The only way to really solve the lead problem is to remove lead from the system, Olson says. Congress is also focusing on PFAS. In January, a congressional task force urged the Biden administration to take immediate steps to address PFAS contamination by, among other things, directing the EPA to phase out any use for chemicals deemed non-essential, to finalize a standard for PFOA and PFOS, and to accelerate cleanup. Representative Debbie Dingell, Democrat, Michigan, a member of the task force, responded to the findings from CR's test, saying they show that we not have any time to waste as we battle these toxic chemicals. She renewed her call for PFAS to be banned and designated as hazardous. Congress must pass my PFAS action and take other concrete action to protect our drinking water, our environment, and our public health, Dingell says. CR agrees that the standard must be set as soon as possible. The burden should be on consumers to monitor contaminants in drinking water, Roldholm says. Pittsburgh's Jim Vaughn says that while government and industry debate, residents of his town are left with unsafe water. The town that has the polluters in it, they're getting their water from upstream. So what's their impetus to fix the problem, he says. The ones downstream have no power over the ones upstream to force them to do that. I just don't think that's fair. To support federal action to clean water, go to cr.org/PFAS petition. How Consumers United to Test Americans' Tap Water. Consumer Reports teamed up with our members and readers of The Guardian U.S. to investigate the nation's drinking water. From a pool of more than 6,000 potential volunteers, CR statisticians winnowed the group to 120 people representing a cross-section of the country and the water systems that service it. That included 12 samples from each of the Environmental Protection Agency's 10 jurisdictional regions. Testers were chosen to provide a mix of urban and rural locations, as well as small and large water systems. We were particularly interested in the PFAS, chemicals notorious for both their health risk and their perseverance in the environment. Each participant received test kits for PFAS as well as for arsenic, lead, and other contaminants, plus a video showing how to collect the samples. That included gathering samples of water before it went through any filter or treatment system that participants might have in their homes. When tests were complete, we sent volunteers advice tailored to their results. We can't draw conclusions about any specific water system because only one sample came from each. But together, results provide powerful insights into the problems faced by the nation as a whole. While much of CR's testing is done in our labs, with our scientists, projects like these need real people, says James Dickerson, Ph.D., CR's Chief Scientific Officer. We are grateful to the readers who helped us share their stories with us. If you'd like to help on future products, go to cr.org/participatory research. And there's a graphic here of a whole of 120 houses, and they're all red colored except for the final two, which are black, which are the only ones that did not test bad. Contaminants in our water. And here's just some more charts and comments here. What are they? Per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are a group of nearly 5,000 compounds with bonds so tight that they are almost indestructible, earning them a reputation as forever chemicals. Used to make products, stain, grease, and water resistance, PFAS can get into water during the manufacture when products degrade in landfills. Risks include high cholesterol, some cancers, and learning delays in children. What CR found in tested water? 46 samples were over CR's recommended total PFAS maximum of 10 points. Arsenic. What is it? A toxic heavy metal naturally found in the ground. Arsenic is also used in pressure-treated lumber and in several other industrial processes. In agriculture, it's used to kill insects on cotton and other crops. Smelting copper or burning coal create arsenic as a byproduct. It can enter water through the natural deposits or industrial or agricultural pollution. It has been linked to cancer as well as lowered IQ in children. CR found in tested water 10 samples were over the CR's recommended arsenic maximum. And lead. What is it? Another heavy metal. Lead was once found in many products, including water pipes. In fact, a lot of people think that the Romans might have suffered seriously because all of their piping was in lead. In 1986, the federal government banned new lead service lines, which bring water into people's homes. But it can still enter drinking water through the millions of lead pipes that remain in the ground or in people's homes. It has been tied to reduced IQ and slowed growth in children, high blood pressure, and reproductive problems. When CR found in tested water, the 118 samples had detectable amounts of lead. CR believes that lead should not be detectable at all in drinking water. There's a couple more items, but I'm not going to start them because we really don't have enough time for them, and I'll read those next week. For now, let's just close out with the road report. Advances in windshield tech. Heads-up displays protect information such as the speed limit and vehicle speed onto the windshield, letting drivers keep their eyes on the road more of the time. Mercedes-Benz use augmented reality in some of its displays to help drivers navigate. What's coming? Augmented reality heads-up displays will soon project additional data such as underpass clearance and bold icons that will make cyclists and pedestrians far easier to see. Heads-up displays can improve safety by providing drivers with vital information without having to take their eyes off the road, says Kelly Funkhauser, who leads the CR's vehicle interface testing. This technology will put even more information right in front of the driver's eyes. What does it cost more to repair an old car than to buy a new one? Almost never. Nobody wants to pay for expensive repairs, but it's usually cheaper to keep your old car going than to buy a new one. Most major repairs won't set you back as much as a few months of new car payments, or come close to the depreciation that can knock 30% off the new car's value in less than a year. But while it may be cheaper, driving an old clunker isn't always smart. A new car will be safer, more enjoyable to drive, and more fuel efficient. And Polestar 2, first drive. Polestar is an electric car from Polestar, a new brand launched by Volvo and its parent company. We appreciate its quick acceleration and agile handling, but its 233-mile range is not great given the price and today's standards. We like its dislike its finicky infotainment system, choppy ride, baffling controls, snug interior, poor visibility, and drab fit and finish. For now, it's available to test drive in only a handful of cities. Service and repair options are also limited. CR's take: you can spend $1,000 less on an EV with more range, nicer interior, and easier to use controls. And 73% of Americans who agree that the government should continue to raise automobile fuel efficiency standards. Good for them. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.